You are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. What is the best way to measure poverty? Intuitively, this question may not seem necessary. Surely we know poverty when we see it. But while we can probably agree that the inhabitants of Dickensian slums were in poverty, in many cases today, things aren't so clear-cut. The IEA's chief economist Julian Jessop examines this question in light of recent research from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, warning of rises in child and pensioner poverty. Interviewed by digital officer Madeline Grant, the pair go through some of the available metrics for determining poverty, from absolute measures and cutoff points to relative ones, which compare individual standards of living with the societies that they live in. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations.
The Joseph Rowntree Foundation published its annual State of the Nation report, which warned of sustained rises in child and pensioner poverty, which they say are the first of their kind for decades. Julian, I understand that you have reservations about perhaps the methodology used to come up with this figure and also the way that it's been so widely reported.
Well, first of all, I want to stress I've got a lot of respect for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and anybody campaigning to reduce poverty in this country. I would, though, have a lot more respect if they were a bit more careful about the way they present their data. In particular, they tend to focus on measures of so-called relative poverty, which are actually an indicator of income inequality. For example, they measure whether somebody has less than 60% of the average wage. Now, that is an important and valuable measure, but it's not what most people would understand by poverty. I think most people, if you ask them what poverty means, it means not having enough money to pay the bills on a day-to-day basis. It means living in sort of material deprivation. It doesn't mean doing slightly less well than your neighbours have been over the recent past. So I think there is a danger that by focusing almost exclusively on measures of relative poverty, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and others is missing what are the most important issues.
So what are the benefits of measuring relative poverty? Because, of course, absolute poverty, as you've defined it, will definitely weed out more of those truly deprived examples. But I think people do conceive of poverty in part based on what they can buy compared to what those around them can buy. And obviously poverty is going to look very different in 21st century Britain than it is in Latin America or sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, for me, the essential point is that you need to use a range of different indicators. If you focus on any single one, then I think you can get up some very misleading headlines. So at one extreme, I think it's ridiculous to say that 30% of children are living in poverty in the UK. But equally, I think it would be wrong to use some global measure of absolute poverty, for example, living on $1 or $2 a day, because on that basis, nobody would be living in poverty in the UK, or at least next to nobody. I think that would be a misleading statement as well. The truth, as ever, lies somewhere in between. It's only by having a broad range of indicators and understanding of some of the particular problems in particular parts of the economy that you can get a true sense of what's actually happening.
Where would you put relative poverty when we're assessing the state of poverty in Britain?
Well, I'd certainly look at it as an important indicator for some of the reasons you discuss. I think it is important that as some parts of the economy or society do better, it's important that others aren't left behind for all sorts of reasons. But focusing on relative poverty does sometimes produce some, frankly, implausibly high numbers that I think are misleading. For example, the data the Joseph Rowntree Foundation use, it's actually published by the Department of Work and Pensions, suggests that something like 30% of children are living in poverty on this definition, which is surely too high a number to be credible if you think about what poverty really means. It also ignores the improvements that have taken place. So, for example, if you look at the percentage of children living in low income or material deprivation, that has continued to fall over the last decade or so. It started off at about 17% in 2004 and it's now fallen to a low of 12% in 2016. Now, clearly those numbers are all still too high, but they are getting better. I think there's some more general issues here. We're focusing too much on one particular measure. There is a danger that if you focus on reducing too broad a measure of poverty, you end up spreading government resources too thinly. You end up potentially achieving all sorts of perverse results. So, for example, you can improve relative poverty simply by reducing incomes at the top of the scale without helping anyone at the bottom. I mean, then the relative poverty measure would improve, but are you actually doing any good? Most importantly of all, I think it discourages the government from targeting efforts on those areas that really matter and from making important reforms to the welfare system for fear of bad publicity. So I think there is a risk that it's not just, you know, quibbling about which data we should choose. It's not just a sort of policy wonkish point here, but actually it can make it more difficult to tackle the real problems of poverty if you're focusing on the wrong measures.
Can you give me a few examples of some of these areas that would suffer if we continue to focus on relative poverty to the detriment of others?
Let me give you a good example from a slightly different area. There have been various studies done recently suggesting that women have borne the brunt of the welfare reforms that have taken place. And that has suggested that somehow there's a gender bias in the way that the reforms are being implemented. Actually, though, a lot of that was due to the fact that child benefit has been withdrawn from higher income households, and traditionally child benefit has been paid to a woman rather than a man. So at least part of the fact that women appear to have been hit harder is simply that, you know, relatively well-off women who've been receiving child benefit are no longer doing so. Similarly, changes to the state pension age. I think it's widely accepted that the state pension age needs to increase. But if you then crunch the numbers, it looks like older people are suffering more from the welfare reforms than younger people. Again, if you dig into the reason why the figures are saying what they're saying, I think you're probably more relaxed about the implications than you would otherwise have been. However, these sorts of nuances often get lost. I mean, the headlines, for example, about poverty, it's very, very rare that a journalist would explain what poverty means. I mean, there are some broadcasters like the BBC who do it properly and actually mention relative poverty and explain it. But generally, the headlines just scream poverty increasing. And I think that is very unhelpful.
Yes, another example I think that is often cited as evidence of increased poverty is the growing use of food banks in Britain. That in itself is not a good metric, since the Trussell Trust didn't expand as a franchise until quite recently, and food banks as a concept didn't really exist 10 years ago.
Well, food banks, again, that's a very good example of something where you need to look beyond the headlines to the nitty-gritty of what's actually happening. And I actually have visited a food bank at the invitation of the Trussell Trust, which I think is a truly excellent charity. And I did learn a lot about the work that they do. I don't think the rise of use of food banks is evidence of an economy-wide problem of poverty. And partly, as you suggest, it's because the Trussell Trust is now operating more areas than it has done in the past. And also, to some extent, the UK is just catching up with other countries where food banks have always been a common way to deliver aid to those people most in need. However, what the Trussell Trust has identified is particular problems in the welfare system, particularly linked to the rollout of universal credit, which has seen an increase in demand for food banks in particular areas as universal credit has been rolled out. So that's an illustration of the point I was making earlier, that if you focus on the big picture of poverty, I sometimes think you miss the individual problems that do need fixing. Ultimately, the government has limited resources. It needs to focus on fixing those problems rather than pretending there's a more general problem of poverty, when in fact on most measures that people would recognise the poverty, things are actually improving.
More broadly, though, we've chosen to focus on poverty today specifically because of this report that's come out. But there are numerous examples of where data is misused to reframe the debate. We spend endless time at the IEA broadcasting on and writing about the gender pay gap. Do you think that these two things are linked, that there was a broader issue where people would prefer to focus on the question of inequality rather than overall prosperity?
Part of the problem, I think, is that newspapers and the media in general like telling bad stories. Bad news sells much better than good news. And there are a number of popular narratives out there, for example, that poverty is increasing or inequality is increasing, or that women are paid significantly less than men for doing the same job, that are the sorts of things that, you know, sell newspapers, that excite the readership. I think it is important sometimes to look beyond those headlines to understand what is really happening. And I have a concern that in focusing on the idea that things are going bad across the board, you end up missing those particular areas where there are some real genuine problems. If we take the gender pay gap as an example, actually there's next to no evidence that men and women are paid significantly different amounts for doing the same job. After all, if they were, then that would be illegal and also economically irrational, because, you know, if companies could indeed afford to pay women significantly less than men, how is it that men manage to get employed at all? But there are undoubtedly some problems of gender discrimination in particular areas. I think there's no doubt about that. The difficulty, though, is that if you paint it as an economy-wide problem, you end up with all sorts of interventions that are actually proving to be counterproductive. So you're increasing the regulatory burden on small firms that have to do all sorts of monitoring that they wouldn't otherwise have to do. You create all sorts of, you know, perverse incentives if companies need to prove that they're employing one group of people the same as another group of people in all circumstances, then they may well decide, actually, let's not employ that group of people at all. Let's keep it simple so we don't have to face any negative headlines. So I think you need to be very careful with government intervention to tackle problems and to make sure you're focusing in on what the problem actually is rather than what it's perceived to be.
I quite agree, but I would say that perhaps we, the free market movement, don't have a lot to say about inequality. When I pose questions about it, we do tend to say, well, look at the overall picture, which is, you know, fair enough. Do you think we might be missing a trick here? Because this is clearly an issue of great importance to many people. And, you know, you can see with the popularity of certain movements in Britain at the moment, books like Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, it's on everyone's list, and we don't really have a great deal to say about it.
Well, I think the free market movement does have some clear principles here. So in particular, we shouldn't be focusing on reducing inequality as an end in itself. The objective instead should surely be to the increase opportunities for all so that everyone is better off, even if, as it happens, some benefit more than others. It's also important, I think, to emphasise the equality of opportunities rather than necessarily the equality of outcomes. The difficulty with that is that it doesn't sound, you know, very, very appealing to the general public. If, for example, you debate poverty statistics with the anti-poverty lobby, there's an assumption that somehow you're in favour of poverty, which is clearly not the case. I've yet to meet anybody left or right who thinks that poverty is
the pro-poverty lobby.
Yes, the pro-poverty lobby, as far as I'm aware, doesn't exist. I think we all agree that we want to get poverty down. Where we disagree is partly the issue of how we measure it, but more importantly, what are the best policies to get poverty down? And there's countless evidence that free market solutions here are far more effective than more and more government intervention. You only need to look at the, say, a billion people who've been lifted out of poverty worldwide over the last few decades as a result of the opening up of emerging economies through globalisation. There might be some legitimate questions about how the benefits of globalisation have been redistributed in certain countries, but as a starting point, I think, you know, I would defend free markets as a way of reducing poverty until the end of my days. I think there's overwhelming evidence that that is the way to do it. There may well be a role for government to address particular problems. And again, the universal credit rollout is an example of how you get difficulties in the implementation of welfare reforms. But overall, I think, you know, less government, more free market forces, that is the best way to allow people themselves to lift themselves out of poverty rather than relying all the time on government handouts.
Julian, from what I've read on this, relative poverty is very often positively correlated with GDP growth. So, for example, it actually fell during the recession.
Well, the thing about relative poverty, of course, is that it looks not only at how poor people are doing, but also how rich people are doing. So if you get a scenario where, as we had in the wake of the financial crisis, a lot of rich people suddenly saw big falls in their bonus payments because they're city traders or whatever it might be, then their income was actually hit harder than those of people further down the income scale. So as a bizarre result, relative poverty actually fell in some of the early stages of the financial crisis. But that's not obviously a good thing, unless you believe inequality is in itself an aim of policy. Then the fact that in a downturn, rich people sometimes do worse than poor people isn't necessarily a positive. Also, if you look at developing countries, as their growth accelerates, often the benefits are felt initially by the relatively well-off. So again, you might get a situation where an economy like China rapidly industrializes and, you know, the bulk of the benefits might go to a few billionaires. So relative poverty apparently increases. On the other hand, poor people are lifted up as well as they move out from relatively low-paying jobs in agriculture into better jobs in manufacturing or services. So you need to be careful focusing just on relative poverty, because you might get all sorts of perverse results in an economy that's facing a recession or a developing economy that's rapidly growing. I'm not against using relative poverty as a measure. What I'm against is solely focusing on that to the exclusion of other things, other inequality measures, and also, of course, absolute poverty, which at the end of the day should be the single most important issue here.
For more blogs, podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.